Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Attention, collectors of vinyl. Have you ever gone into a record store and felt overwhelmed by all the unfamiliar options? Are you frustrated by the constantly increasing prices of classic rock staples? Do you avoid streaming music or long for the days when music was recommended to you by a friend instead of an algorithm? If the answer to any of these questions is yes, then check out I'd Buy That for a Dollar, a podcast about inexpensive, common, and underappreciated records that are waiting to be rediscovered. Each week, hosts Sean, Jeremy, and Peter discuss an album and the artist's history. Previous episodes include selections by the Isley Brothers, the Carpenters, the Doobie Brothers, and Donna Summer, among others. Become a bargain bin pro and impress all your friends with cool music trivia. Listen to I'd Buy That for a Dollar wherever you get your podcasts. Please consider supporting Black Women United YEG for the protection and advancement of Black women and girls in Alberta. You can learn more about them at bwunited.ca. They are always looking for donations and volunteers. So please, again, support Black Women United YEG for the protection and advancement of Black women and girls in Alberta. Again, that website is bwunited.ca.
Hey, this is Nicole calling from Hamilton, and I needed to let everyone know that I really proudly support Vish and Creative Control. I have for many years, I will for many more, as long as he keeps delivering these amazing interview podcasts. When you hear one of Vish's interviews, you think he's known this guest for years, they're good friends. But the truth is, he approaches every interview, whether it's sort of up-and-coming indie artists or established icons or like famous, intimidating comedians, with a really deep, genuine curiosity. So he's never met this person, and the same really warm candor as though he's known them forever. I think it really lends to a great chat, no matter who he's talking to. And for that reason, I think you should throw Vish, like, what, $1 a month? He's got jokes. The jokes make it worth it. Support Creative Control on Patreon.
To make your flexible monthly donation to Creative Control, please visit patreon.com/creativecontrol today. I'm Visha's wife, and remember, when you name a dog Janet or Timothy, you are dragging humanity down just a little bit.
Steve Von Till is an accomplished musician, lyricist, poet, and elementary school teacher currently based in Spirit Lake, Idaho. Well known for his role as a songwriter, guitarist, and vocalist in the band Neurosis, as well as running the fiercely independent label New Rot Recordings, Von Till is also a prolific artist in his own right. Working under the banner Harvest Man and also under his own given name, Von Till's solo work is often gentler but no less intense than the punk-infused metal of Neurosis, and his lyrical explorations are equally introspective and philosophical. In that vein, Von Till has just issued his first book, Harvest Man, 23 Untitled Poems and Collected Lyrics, as well as a riveting new solo album called No Wilderness Deep Enough, both of which are available now via New Rot Recordings. Steve and I recently connected for an extensive conversation about his role as a teacher working for an education board grappling with a pandemic, his interests in poetry, philosophy, and mythology, the power of punk and escaping genre pigeonholes, his new poetry collection and solo record, future plans for Neurosis and New Rot, and much more. A part of the Entertainment One Network with the support of listeners like you, who follow and subscribe to this podcast and spread the word about it, and make flexible monthly donations at patreon.com/creativecontrol, and Massey Hall's concert film series, live at masseyhall.com, where you can stream dozens of 30-minute films for free, including performances by past podcast guests like members of Rio Statics, plus in-kind support from Pizza Trocadero, The Bookshelf, and Planet Bean Coffee in Guelph, and Granddad's Donuts in Hamilton. This is the 561st episode of Creative Control, featuring the multi-talented Steve Von Till with your host, me, Vish Khanna. Hi, Steve. How's it going?
Good. How are you, Vish?
I'm well. It's nice to have you on the show. Where in the world are you?
I am in my home studio in the barn outside my house in Spirit Lake, Idaho, north of Coeur d'Alene.
I see. How are things going in Idaho and America from your perspective at the moment, given the dual, at least two calamities that I can think of? There's the pandemic as we're speaking. There's also the social unrest. How are things going in Idaho?
Well, it's definitely a strange place to be. With regards to most of it, you know, we live on 12 acres of forest. So if you turn off the news and don't go to town, days can be no different than any other day.
Hmm.
But as soon as you hit town and you realize that even the idea of wearing a mask to protect your fellow citizens has become politicized, it's just crazy. It's insanity. I don't know what the hell's going on out there, but it doesn't feel good, any of it.
I involuntarily chuckled as I've been doing, talking to guests about this super serious stuff, and that is a reflex that I acknowledge in myself. Are you able to laugh this off in any way? You invoke the phrase, I think, insane or insanity. Like, there's this sense that this is absurd, but are you processing it on any other intellectual or emotional level, or is it simply, well, this is just the way it is here right now?
Kind of all of it. I mean, sometimes even if you choose to ignore the shit show in the media for, you know, some days, I just feel like the energy in the air is very thick. Hmm. You know, like when you have this many people globally stressed out and worried about health, about money, about how to survive, you know, especially in our independent music world. Anybody whose way of earning a living had to do with live music is just hosed, and America doesn't have much of a safety net for folks.
Yeah.
You know, so it's and you know, parents and elder people are worried, you know, and the way isolation interacts with people's mental health issues or what have you. I think it's, I don't know, it's just intense. And the level of information and disinformation. I'm an elementary school teacher for my day job, and just in how our community is planning on starting the school year is a very stressful and contentious thing to be involved in, you know? So it's.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we're, as parents, so I'm, we're parents here, and we are just getting slow trickles of information from our provincial government here and the educational boards, and it's inconsistent, and to me, it's a little, yeah. It's illogical. It doesn't seem to, I don't understand the constant lack of foresight. Like, I don't, that's where I'm at. We keep seeing people make mistakes and not learn from them, which I think in your talk, you were talking about the energy in the air, and I feel like there's a lot of that in the air, just this in-your-face problem where a solution or at least a recourse has been determined, but then, like, within weeks, it's the old flawed policy is enacted or the flawed action is redone. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's, I don't... No, why?
Yeah, I think at least with school boards and stuff, I think it's a lot of public opinion of the community come in and will influence the people in charge. So even if people want to make the right decision, I think they feel pressured not to by a certain mass ignorance or whatever the politics of your community are.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Well, everything has been politicized, every single thing. So that makes it complicated. I've been thinking about how we're blaming each other for everything all the time lately. And as I don't know what it means. Do you know what I mean? Like, it just feels like everyone is... I said we're getting weird information from the government and the education system. There's a subtext there where I'm like kind of blaming them. And that's really spreading. Do you know what I'm getting at there?
Yeah, you know, divide and conquer is the oldest trick in the book. And it feels like they could, you know, by they, I don't even know who I'm talking about. I'm not a conspiracy theorist necessarily, but we're all volunteering for the divide and conquer.
Hmm.
You know, it feels like everybody's just digging in their heels about their issues. And some of it comes from misinformation from the top or the level of uncouth ignorance that is kind of giving everybody a permission to be uncouth and ignorant. But then it seems to come from all things. Like, it just, we're creating an impossible situation, you know?
Yeah. Again, that energy, and then that situation is either, I can't tell if the energy in the air thing that you alluded to, which I think is accurate, I can't tell if we're feeding that energy, if the energy is feeding into us now. Like, it's confusing. It's
probably a feedback loop.
Yes, you know? Yes, exactly. It's a hard one. I mean, you and I are not going to resolve this together today. We're not.
No, we're not going to save the world on the podcast today, unfortunately.
I'm afraid not. I want to congratulate you on your first volume of poetry here. It is called Harvest Man, 23 Untitled Poems and Collected Lyrics. Did I have that right?
Yeah, thank you.
You're welcome. So how far back does this work sort of stem? I believe it's about 2 decades worth of work, right?
Well, the lyrics are definitely 2 decades, decades worth. And I have written poetry my entire adult life, but it's never been with the intent to publish it. It was always just kind of my own personal self-expression. It lived and died in my personal journals, and mostly would become fodder for lyrics when I needed to find words, phrases, lines that I needed to serve a song. But those 23 poems, those were all written last year, kind of in the in the process of writing the lyrics for the new record, I had stolen two lines from a poem. We have the sea and we will always have the sky. And the poem I took them from, I felt it was perfect. Even though I don't publish them, or I hadn't up until that point yet, I felt extremely guilty about taking those two lines for the song from a poem which would then be rendered useless without its two best lines.
But just to clarify, you stole lines from a poem that you yourself wrote?
Yeah, I plagiarized myself.
Now, how did that make you feel? How did both of you feel about that? The one who wrote the poem and the one who stole the lines?
Well, guilty. But the positive aspect of that was I had come to the conclusion that maybe I should write a series of poems with the intention of not butchering them for lyrics and not turning them into just a place where I go mining for phrases. And so I sat down and wrote every day for a little while, at off time at school or in the mornings before I left the house. And pretty quickly I had a group, including the one I stole the lines from, of about 23 poems. I thought, well, that's a great prime number. I'm into that number. Mm-hmm. And none of them have titles, so they seem like they're a related body of work. And I'm going to go ahead and let those two lines live in a poem and a song. And they'll both, and then the idea of, first I thought, well, I'll just go to Kinko's and make a chapbook for friends or whatever. But then as I thought about it more, I thought, well, shit, I'm 50 years old. If I don't own the fact that I write poetry by now, when am I ever going to? And maybe there's an audience for it if I tie it into my lyrics and kind of make that connection and release it simultaneously with my my upcoming record, which is also kind of out of my comfort zone because it's a lot prettier than anything I've done. So I got these two kind of projects that are pulling me out of whatever self-imposed expectations I had on myself and where my artwork sits, and just kind of pushed my own boundaries, which felt like a good thing to do.
Right. So the album in question is called No Wilderness Deep Enough, and it's beautiful. In my music library here, I find it striking that it says unknown genre. So it doesn't know what to do with it, I guess, or maybe I'm supposed to enter something in there. Anyway, I'm curious about, you say you've been writing poetry most of your life, and obviously that, you also mentioned that it maybe served as either fodder for or maybe even just a writing exercise for lyrics in the end. Your poetry informs your lyric writing. Do you have a sense of what first spurred you on to express yourself in that way in particular? Because you're well regarded as a guitar player, as a musician, as a virtuoso in many ways. I'm just curious about your creative expression, I should say. What sort of came first? Was it writing things down? Was it playing?
It was definitely playing. I mean, I loved hard rock radio when I was a kid and did what most of us that came of age in the late 70s, 80s kind of did, followed that hard rock, arena rock as far as it would take us, and discovered heavy metal along the way until punk rock came along. And then, the whole DIY punk rock movement of the 80s is still where I feel I formed most of my values with regards to art and self-expression and how art and commerce are related and all of those things. Especially the do-it-yourself mentality. I mean, I think, so it was the love of music at first. And then that drive that the punk rock gave us that weren't the shredders on instruments or the trained musicians or the whatever, that gave us the permission to, hey, you don't have to be good. You just have to mean it.
Right.
You just have to say it with conviction. And so, that started like, okay, well, I don't have to be as good as these guys that are learning their Eddie Van Halen riffs down the road. I'll never figure that out, but I can bash out these few chords and really mean it. And that led to songwriting and creating our own stuff. And, luckily being in a collective like Neurosis growing up where we wanted to kind of transcend our teenage angst hardcore-ness and kind of blow it open into a more existential place sonically and emotionally, then obviously lyrically that had to follow, you know? And
yeah, yeah.
Young guys, you know, I was a young man in college. I was getting a sociology degree, and so I was reading a lot of psychology, getting into Jungian psychology, getting into comparative mythology, although I'd always loved mythology since I was a kid. And, you know, that led to a lot of different roads, the American Transcendentalists, Thoreau and Whitman, and reading Joseph Campbell and his books on comparative mythology and the hero's journey and Carl Jung. And all of that led also to poetry and philosophy. And I became very interested in shamanic practices around the world, earth-based spiritualities, pre-Christian spiritualities. And just all of that kind of ended up in the blender of being a young, inspired man surrounded by other young, inspired people doing crazy stuff. And it just kind of led down this road, you know?
So, I mean, some of the things you've just alluded to in terms of Jungian psychology, philosophy, all the things you've been talking about, there are certain cliches around metal lyrics, punk lyrics, you know, some are
for sure
fantastical. Yeah. Like, again, I view them as cliches, and I'm not trying to pigeonhole any genre.
I'm right there with you.
Right. I'm just curious, though, as someone who's clearly drawn to the written word, did you find particular writing or writers, even songwriters, that spoke to you more in their explorations of rather, you know, whether it would be introspective psychological expression or a full-fledged exploration of mythology, if you will? Are there any particular writers or writing styles in punk or metal or rock music that particularly resonated with you and inspired you to write?
Well, I don't write prose, but I was definitely inspired by a lot of, I mean, and some are also cliches in their own way. Jack London and his writing of the Alaska and then the tundra areas up there. He was huge. Oh, the Irish poet Yeats was pretty big for me because he was also, he transcended that kind of being into his Irish heritage and the Celtic mythology, but also being very much a late 1800s kind of occultist. You know, so he went into a lot of weird spots. But there was a native activist, a spokesperson for the American Indian movement named John Trudell, who passed away several years ago, who combined poetry on top of tribal drum songs and traditional songs. And I always found that really compelling because he was clearly a modern guy, a seeker, seeking to reconnect with his ancient roots and ancestry. That was very inspiring.
This is fascinating. Like I've asked you a songwriting question and you're alluding to kind of more, I don't know, cultural studies, anthropology almost. And as I read through this volume of poetry, I just in my mind, I kept thinking, well, there's some real existential stuff going on here. A person trying to negotiate their sense of place in the world. I mean, within that, there's, I think, a lot of mortality stuff as well. I mean, that's all in there, isn't it? How lives are lived, why they are lived a certain way, where they're lived and why as well, and how they end. That's kind of all swimming around in your work, isn't it?
Yeah, I can't seem to get out of that one. That seems to be the and it doesn't matter. It could have been neurosis since the early 90s through all my solo work, although it becomes, you know, more personal, obviously. But it is. It's always kind of zooming back and forth between the micro and the macro. And even when I know lines are specifically about personal relationships or, you know, even, you know, day-to-day trials and tribulations that we all go through, you know, I've just never been comfortable wearing it on my sleeve like somebody like Bill Callahan might or something, you know, or it's like almost too much information about what went wrong in your relationship. You know, like I feel the need to hide behind a thick layer of natural metaphor.
Right. But then in this volume, in your latest records and in this volume of poetry and lyrics, it feels like a bit of an outpouring, a revelatory outpouring. Do you know what, I think you kind of talked about the origin of why this collection has been compiled on some level, but on a sort of deeper emotional level, like why you, I guess you said it, like you're at an age where you feel like this, the time to do something like this is now, but is there anything else going on? Is there something, I know you're a parent, right? You're dad.
Yeah. My kids are 21 and 18. They're all, you know, up and out of the house. So kind of
right,
completed but, that yeah, chapter, yeah. But yeah, being, I mean, as you know, cause you're there, entering parenthood, if you are any sort of compassionate, thinking, feeling human being, that's going to completely change and reprioritize everything in your life, mm-hmm. including your creative pursuits.
Mm-hmm.
Some people take it the wrong way and feel that, oh, well, now I have to be a grown-up and stop doing my band or whatever.
You know, yeah, there's the
stuff like that, you know. But I think the kids need to see us do our inspired work. You know,
yeah, I think there's that stuff swimming around there too. Kind of, I don't mean to say vocational, and I don't mean to apply vocational to a cultural. I keep saying cultural expression, but I guess it is. I keep meaning to say creative expression, but I guess it's coming out as cultural expression. It's both. to take the load off me there. I guess what I'm getting at is, I feel like at a certain age, you start to subconsciously contemplate your legacy and what about your life you want known. And so I think when you're in a position like yours where you're, a lot of your life has been marked by records, you know, the work you've done, the time, what you were thinking at the time. If you think of records, they're documents of a time and place in your own life. In a sense, your ancestors, like, or rather your, I guess your children, the people coming after you, your family, have things that some people will never have. You know, we've all heard the cliches about, well, I went to the attic and I found this box from my great-great-grandfather that I didn't even know about. Some of us have been constantly making things and releasing them to the public. And I mean, these days, Norm MacDonald has that joke about how, like, back in the day, everyone had a single photograph of themselves. And now, you know, if you want to, you can be like, do you want to see a photo of my granddad for every single day of his life on my phone? And so the way of actually applying some sense of yourself in the world has changed a lot. I just wonder if you came to a point where you're like, I kind of want something about me known and if my children want to know about me, they have certain artifacts and they have family photos and whatnot. But here is a thing I'm making that might not be for me now. It might be for them or other generations in my family. Does any of that make any sense?
It does make sense, but I don't believe that any of that was any sort of conscious.
No, I don't think
drive.
It's conscious.
Yeah, because I think whenever I consciously try to do something, it usually sucks in comparison to when I just sort of let something naturally evolve and flow through. But I mean, I don't know where the drive comes from. So maybe you've tapped on something that I haven't considered of that, you know.
Well, I'd when like you to- say I when you say I reached an age where I thought mm-hmm. I should do this. What is the subtext there? I reached an age is
yeah,
a contemplation that you're on the other side of something.
I don't know. Maybe half a century being 50. I don't know.
Yeah.
I see this as kind of a the latest kind of step in my self-growth, and I think both the album and the poetry book kind of speak to it. There hasn't been a single revelation or a single event which spurred this. I think it's been a slow step by step, starting from the beginning, way of getting here. But I'm learning how to get out of my own way. And learning mm-hmm. how to put aside the voices of self-doubt or self-criticism or imposter syndrome. Who am I to think I can put out poetry? Like, you know, that's ridiculous. You're not qualified. You know, all these voices in there which can stop you. Or had I not been in a hallucinatory state of jet lag in my wife's parents' house in Germany when I first came up with the first simple chord progressions of the record, maybe I would have intellectually skipped over them. Like, what is that? That's just two simple piano chords. Who cares?
Right.
You know, but it's like learning to trust that the process happens, whether I'm actively seeking it or whether it's seeking me, and I just need to surrender to it, or I just need to provide the conditions to allow the accidents to happen, you know?
Right. Okay. Yeah, that's fair. And I didn't mean to put something on you in terms of why you might be doing this stuff now. You mentioned the jet lag situation. You were in Germany for, what was it, to visit family or something like that?
Yeah, my wife is from northern Germany, and so that's where my in-laws live. And the land where they live, actually the exact house site where they live, her family has been on that exact same house site for over 500 years.
Wow.
You know, plowing that same land. And it's very different, you know, than we are here in the kind of mountainous West. You know, like that land has been manipulated for a long time. It is very cultivated. It's very heavy, and especially for, you know, even by old world standards of Europe, for one family to not have even moved across town for 500 years, is a long time. So there's kind of a weight there, kind of a density.
Well, it sounds like the opposite of restlessness. It sounds like a family that knows itself. A people that know itself and know what they are.
Yeah, it's some, you know, I'm the child of the westward migrations. My family's never stopped moving. So it's interesting for me to contemplate. Like, I think I have some sort of deep, unspecified longing to know what it's like to be that connected to a place.
Yeah, I feel like that comes across in your work. Would you agree? Like, there is a general searching. It's like a, I don't know if it's restlessness, but when I'm applying an umbrella definition or assessment of a huge body of work, but that's in your work a lot, isn't it? This notion of questioning and searching for something. It's sort of undefined, but it's sort of wondering about what the here and now means in the grand scheme of things. Is that, I know, again, that's maybe a generalized statement that could be applied to only almost any artist, but I do feel like that is in there within your work. Is that fair?
Yeah, that's more than fair. Yeah. It's always been an unspecified search, an unspecified longing, sometimes even an unspecified sadness. And I'm not someone who suffers depression or anything like that, but there is this certain melancholy aspect to this search for something that maybe doesn't exist or that I'll never know.
So that is, okay, so you're saying it's not a, I think you're kind of getting at the fact that you're not prone to depression, so to speak, but when I read your lyrics, and some of the questioning is really about, you know, what are we doing in these lives? And so it gives me some pause, having interviewed or had friends who have raised these questions and not been able to reconcile them, if you know what I mean.
Yeah,
So you're saying you're okay in your search, in your searching, in your questioning. You're not
self-diagnosed.
Well, yes, exactly. And you're not mired by this, so to speak. It's just when you express yourself, these kinds of questions are swimming around in your lyrics and even in some of this. Like, we haven't even gotten to the soundscapes of the new album, which are a little off kilter, a little surreal on some level. You mentioned some basic piano chords, but I don't really think of your work as basic in any way in terms of the latest record. So, yeah, I don't know. I guess I'm just, first of all, I guess I'm checking in to make sure you're okay.
Yeah.
Which is, are you all right there, Steve? Everything's okay as far as you're concerned?
Yeah, I'm good. And in fact, I think there are many people that are not, and so I don't like to make light of it. You know,
yeah,
like I feel very fortunate that whatever it is that I confront inside myself, I have artistic modes of expression in order to deal with in a positive manner.
Right.
And that in some ways those aspects which might be negative, when you have a creative outlet, then you can actually look to them almost as a positive wells of inspiration, you know. So in that way, you have a sense of gratitude to be able to look deeply into those behind the curtain, I guess, so to speak.
I mean, one of the things about your body of work is, I alluded to earlier to the fact that the new album is designated as unknown genre. And I feel like from your time in Neurosis to Harvest Man to now working under your own name, that unknown genre thing is a big part of that, right? I mean, this notion of creating space for yourself, whether it's in your bands or as yourself, to be free to do anything you want, that's a big component of your creative expression, right?
Absolutely. And I, you know, that again, that goes back to the formational years of that DIY punk movement. I saw that as, fuck you, we do what we want. We express ourselves in the most pure, honest, and emotionally intense manner that we can. And it turned out that that was not true, that it actually had to be narrowed down to a genre and have rules and right. stuff like that. And then you have to bounce around these ridiculous genres, you know? Post-punk, post-metal, you know, blah, 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 whatever it is. And so maybe it even transcends that 80s time I was talking about. It just goes back to all art, music, and poetry, and maybe even the, here I go getting freaking existential again, but maybe the origin of all language is our need to talk of something deeper, more honest, more original thinking, something beyond shelter me, feed me, reproduce, you know?
Well, yeah, there's a certain resistance to convention that occurs in almost every aspect of life. Like, as you're speaking, I'm thinking back on, like, when I was in university, I took a intro to jazz 101, like an intro to jazz history class. And there was this point that strikes me as being relevant to our conversation where a cohort of jazz musicians, to separate themselves from swing and mainstream jazz, they coined the phrase bebop. And it's kind of like what happened with rap music and hip-hop. And I kind of think that punk became commodified, and then it became hardcore. And then when that became commodified, it became post-hardcore. And so there's always these artistic resistance to the genre signifier, which I think is just a resistance to the marketing and, I don't know, mass appeal that gloms on to a true expression. And I've gone on a bit of a tangent here from what you were just discussing, but that seems to be what's... You guys have... Neurosis have been called post-metal. What the hell does that mean? It means you're not metal.
Yeah, don't even know. And that... Well, in fact, in reacting to what you just said, I'm looping back to when you first asked me about the songs, like what writers influence you. And one thing that popped into my head, which I didn't say, but now it's circled back to, is like, okay, so if all these genres like have no meaning, where do things sit artistically? And I think, okay, well, when I think about lyric writing, I can put Rollins era Black Flag right next to Dylan once I realized that he wasn't a flowery hippie, that he was actually a super intense poet, you know, with who rebelled against that whole closed-minded world that tried to embrace him with his folk material. And you know,
still doing that, if I might say,
very well. I'm a hero. So, you know, you know, Dylan and Patti Smith can live next to Black Flag. Joy Division can live next to the American Transcendentalists. It, to me, in a genre that of art and music and poetry, which exists in a more related to each other than things that might be next to them in the record bin.
Yeah, and that's kind of how I process music and culture myself, and that's evident maybe in even the guest list on this particular podcast. Like, I'm looking for things that are true and real and feel true and real to me.
Yeah.
And it sounds to me that you are doing the same in your own expression. And I've started this line of conversation just to get at the distinction you make between your work in Neurosis and this work that you've been doing on your own. I mean, I feel like you all created this space where you could explore other interests beyond that sort of pop, more, I guess, core expression. I mean, people will say, oh, the guy from Neurosis is on this podcast, but right. at the same time, there will be other people who say, oh, the guy from Harvest Man is on this podcast. Like, you've created these these worlds of reception for yourself. I guess, first question, what is the sort of status of Neurosis at the moment?
Well, luckily, we didn't have any plans for this year. Once we got home from last year's tour, we're kind of in let's go back and recharge mode, and then everything shifted. So,
okay,
just kind of holding pattern.
Yeah, so it's a going concern. I just wanted to try to figure out if its status or its activity dictates when you express yourself or as Harvest Man, if you will. Is there a connection? I know it could be a downtime versus what have you thing, but you've created the space for yourself probably for a reason. And I'm not trying to suggest that Neurosis doesn't give you a place for this, but you recognize that they are kind of different expressions. What actually prompted you to think, I have this stuff that doesn't fit that, it doesn't fit Neurosis. I need to make something of my own. Beyond Sonics, what was it? What was it exactly that made you feel like you wanted to do this?
It goes back to learning that lesson I guess I would call it honoring the muse, getting out of my own way, not talking myself out of things, and allowing that creative spirit to push itself to the forefront when it needs to. So it's more specifically, in the late 90s, I'd always had home recording equipment. Since high school in mid-80s, I had cassette four tracks, graduating to reel-to-reels, and mm-hmm. And now I'm sitting in a room with way too much stuff.
digital recording and whatnot.
Yeah. Probably. Synthesizers, guitars, amps, yeah. All of, yeah. Yeah.
Right.
So it's always been a thing that I like to do. And there was a point in the late 90s where I was living in the Mission District in San Francisco, and I had found myself recording a lot late at night. Like, you know, when you live in a beehive city like that, like, the world isn't quiet until 3 a.m., mm-hmm. you know? Mm-hmm. And I found myself recording all these very subdued acoustic guitar, almost whisper voice songs, and with no intention. I had no project. I wasn't writing them intentionally. Hmm. I just wasn't stopping them from appearing. And when I realized I actually had a whole body of work that had no home, it clearly wasn't Neurosis music, which was more of a group kind of meat grinder process where all five of us have to be constantly destroying and rebuilding things, following this kind of energy that's greater than us as individuals.
Right, right.
You know, so this felt very personal. And so I thought, well, shit, I guess the thought of coming up with another band name was awful, because that's probably the worst position anybody would need to find themselves in,
right?
Is thinking of a band name. So I guess I thought, okay, this is personal. I'm just going to release it under my own name. And that's how As the Crow Flies, my first bit, came out. They were just quiet songs recorded in my bedroom when the world was sleeping. And that just the process of putting that out there went, okay, now I have this pathway. Now I have this thing that felt very necessary to express, and now I've given myself permission to keep following that pathway. That's kind of how my poetry book feels now. Like, okay, now I've finally done it.
Hmm.
Now I can't. Now I have another pathway of creativity that I can pursue publicly. You know, that I can put out into the universe there, and that feels worthy of occupying space.
A kind of basic perception of what you're describing is that your solo expression is something of a, I don't want to say reaction to your work in Neurosis, but it is a complementary form on some level, or it's different. And on some level, being in a loud rock band might inform someone when they decide that their other expression is going to be sort of the opposite of that, if you will, like whisper vocals, quieter acoustic guitars. Tell me what you make of that, but also I'm curious if your work as a solo performer and writer has informed what you bring back to Neurosis. I'm just curious about the parallels there, I guess, or how the two worlds meet.
Yeah, for sure. I think, I mean, I guess if you looked at my record collection or what I listened to my whole life, I mean, you would be able to pick out the Neurosis influences, you know, the Joy Division, mm-hmm. Black Flag, Black Sabbath, Pink Floyd, that stuff. But, you know, you'd also find Buffy St. Marie albums and Bob Dylan records and Lowe albums and Brian Eno albums, you know, all these different things that have influenced, I would say, Neurosis as well, just because I think everything in our kind of way to try to, even though we do constantly get pigeonholed, in our way to kind of blow those doors wide open for ourselves within heavy music. I mean, it's still heavy rock. It's still guys yeah. yelling at you with loud, distorted guitars. But I think we have perceived that everything you see, feel, or hear will influence it in some ways, whether they're movies, books, media, or hopefully life itself, bringing the original factor and the authenticity of your self-expression to the table. But in how they're complementary, I think, yeah, maybe there was a desire to do something. I mean, obviously it happened. It wasn't cerebral. It was just on a gut level. So maybe there yeah. was just this impetus to do something soft and hopefully no less intense, but that you can be intense with quiet, somber, beautiful music, just like you can with heavy music. And, sometimes more so, actually. And,
well, they can be. I've read people talk about how those kinds of oscillations are sort of physically motivated. I think I feel like the story around Neil Young's album Silver and Gold is that he got back from a Crazy Horse tour, so his voice was pretty ragged in a way, or it had a tone to it just from singing every night or on tour, and so he came home and made a quiet record, relatively quiet record, and just kind of liked the way his voice sort of sounded all messed up. Like it didn't quite sound like him. It was a bit, you know, worn down, but it also had an interesting tone to it. So there's that relationship between his loud voice and his more quiet voice, and they're totally physically, you know, like, there's like a visceral connection between the two. And I guess I just wondered if that's sort of swimming around there. Like you get back from a Neurosis tour and on the one hand you need to rest, but on the other you're like, I have things I need to say and sing. Is that the case with you in any way?
I think that may be. I mean, again, not consciously, but it makes total sense when you're saying it. I think when you get home from a tour of loud, heavy music, the last thing you want to put on is loud, heavy music.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, you talk to bands who have been on tour lately, and I've talked to so many who are like, we don't even listen to music in the van. We listen to podcasts. We listen to comedy records. We don't listen to music because we're just, it's music, music, music all the time.
Exactly. That's probably why on tour, I don't know how many hours I've got logged into two albums, like Brian Eno's On Land mm-hmm. ambient record and Stars of the Lid, Tired Sounds Of. Mm-hmm. I probably have more hours logged into those two records from plane flights and bus drives than any other records in my collection, just because they are gentle.
yeah. I think I've been talking about this with people of late, just the physical toll. I alluded to this when I was interviewing Elizabeth Powell of Land of Talk, that Guy Picciotto from Fugazi made a point of telling me that, like, as much as he, you know, probably misses playing in Fugazi, he doesn't, the physical toll of being in that band and touring in that band left him kind of physically destroyed. Like singing every night kind of tore up his voice in a way, and the physical, the amount of exertion that those guys put into their shows got to him. Not to the point where I think that's why they ceased, but he made a point of saying, like, to be honest, like it was harder than maybe people recognize.
Yeah, when you choose, and I think we would relate to that, because one thing that Fugazi did that I feel we do in our own way is we feel that when you're playing music with that level of emotional intensity, it feels disingenuous to not physically embody it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Like you wish you could kind of stand still and not give yourself whiplash or, you know? And I'd like to be able to put on my best Billy Zoom face and stand there and rock it, but that just doesn't doesn't happen for me, you know. And it can tear you up. And those guys gave 100% plus, well, for sure. And
yeah, I think the mental energy this suspension in time, I hope, is giving people a bit of a chance to just think about what we do and how we process things. Like that band and your band, I'm sure, is the same. Like there's a lot of intricacy going on in terms of remembering lyrics, remembering complicated guitar parts, as you say, doing all of that while being sort of conscious of being a performer, like the physical aspect of this isn't the sound check, this is the show. People came to see a show. I've got to do all those things. Like I've been watching some late 90s Fugazi concerts on YouTube and just watching someone like Guy play these weird guitar parts while singing these intricate lyrics tunefully. And it's mind-boggling. Like, I'm like, what a freak that guy was. And I didn't even know. I didn't think of it. Every time I saw them, I didn't think twice about it. But now that I've just sort of thought about our general physical and health, like our states of being, that's like a lot of what's going on. Like, we're thinking about our mental health a lot, thinking about our physical health a lot. And so when I look at things now, I kind of think about that. Like, how is that human being physically flying through the air to dunk that basketball? And what is it like the next day? Like, I'm just having these thoughts in my head. So I can only imagine with you, you must a lot of ice packs after Neurosis shows. What was going on?
Yeah, for sure. Ice and nursing injuries and...
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, but I, it's funny to mention it because over the last bunch of years, you know, despite the fact that and people might have anything to complain about touring, I mean, really the last decade, I've tried to just look at it with an immense sense of gratitude that any chance I have to be able to travel, to make music, and anybody else gives a shit about my weird form of self-expression is amazing.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, the chances of that being possible, I have nothing but gratitude for it. And my body is used to, you know, because I'm, again, being an elementary school teacher, most of my touring time where I'm free, I mean, occasionally I can take small bits of time off of work and do long weekends or what have you, and I've always had support to do that, you know.
Like, yeah.
Hey, sorry, I've got to go to Holland for the weekend. It's going to take me 4 days to get there and back, you know. But I can feel in my body now that it's August that I have not been on tour this summer. Like,
yeah.
I've got a restless physicality sitting there, and usually, I mean, I don't, unless I'm making music or recording in the studio or whatever, I don't usually play a lot of guitar unless I'm getting ready to write songs or creating songs or rehearsing songs. But I have felt the need to stay up late for the last couple of weeks and just do BS learning of Led Zeppelin songs or whatever on things I don't know how to do just to keep my fingers moving. Otherwise, it'll be like an entire year of not moving my fingers enough.
Right.
You know, like,
yeah.
And even though I have no reason to, I've reverted into being a night owl, whereas usually throughout the school year and every other time, I'm an early riser and, you know, up at 4 or 5 a.m. taking care of business and early to bed. But I've completely flipped, I think, just because my body thinks I should be on tour right now.
Right.
Like I'm on a yearly cycle.
Yeah, it's like a muscle memory thing happening throughout your entire body. Yeah. What I didn't ask you this, and I meant to. You're an elementary school teacher. What grade do you teach? What do you teach?
Fourth grade, so that's 9-year-olds turning 10. And everything. You know, when you're a classroom teacher, it's reading, writing, math,
right.
Science,
okay.
History. Yeah.
Okay, so you're a general teacher. My son is just about to enter some version of the fourth grade. We're not sure if it's going to be online or in person.
Virtual fourth grade, good luck. Yeah.
They've told us, by the way, that they're dividing the year into quarters. Semestered quarters, and you have the choice of either sending your children to the school or doing virtual learning, which will encompass classroom amalgamation among schools across the city, which we just found this out, and I don't exactly know.
Interesting. So it's two options?
So far, I mean, they'll monitor things, but they haven't really said what happens when a child or a teacher gets sick with the thing. And so I'm leaning towards, let's sit the first quarter out and see how things go. Let's sit out November, September, yeah. November. We'll do that virtually. And then, because as you would know as a teacher, I'm sure that we've all been talking about, I'm surprised it's only the second wave at this point, but everyone's talking about what the second wave will be looking like. And I don't want to take a chance in spreading this into our community and also my family getting sick.
It's a rare time. Like, there truly are no good options.
No. I'm trying to, I said this to someone the other day. I went through this with when my mother was diagnosed with breast cancer. They told us exactly what was going to happen over like a 5 or 6 month plan. But we were panicking every month, even though everything they said was going to happen was kind of happening. And then by the end of it, you know, thankfully she's okay at the moment. She's okay. Like it everything they said over that was going to happen happened, and we didn't listen. And so in this case, I've tried to apply what I learned a year or two ago to this scenario where all the epidemiologists said, we're looking at, you know, 16 to 24 months of this. But as you know, Steve, every week there seems to be a shift in that, or like maybe we'll get the vaccine now and maybe it'll work. And I'm trying to apply the patience I didn't to my mother's situation to this and sort of say, we have to all just ride this out. But I don't know. Are you able to cope that way, or like to be patient with this?
I guess we're forced into it. I mean,
if
we're impatient, we're only torturing ourselves.
It's really a lot easier said than done. I don't mean to be glib, but I am trying to say, because people around me are panicking and I have panic. I'm trying not to put it out or convey it into the world too much. But to me, I'm like, I'm going to listen to the doctors and the experts and just say, we've got a couple years of this, like this. And yes, like all my in-laws and everyone's like, but the children are going to suffer from the social isolation. And I'm like, yeah, but at least they'll be alive. I mean, I'd like us all to survive this. And then, again, it's much easier said than done, but I know there's a mental health toll here.
And, for sure. And for every family has its own complications, you know, with that, those scenarios. I mean, I don't know what your guys' situation is and if somebody can be home.
We're home. My wife and I are working from home, which is fortunate. We have we're very fortunate to have these white collar kind of jobs. I'm trying to view this as a bonding exercise, but it's difficult. We don't have a lot of space to ourselves and time to ourselves, and that's an issue. But I'm trying to view it all as bonding time.
Yeah, for sure. And then there's those families where both parents have to go to work.
Yeah.
And they don't have, they've got lower working class jobs, and they have to leave their kid, who may or may not, for whatever reason, be the ones that need school the most.
Yeah.
maybe they're already behind.
Right.
You know, and those kids are not going to be able, if there's no parents home, are not going to be able to interact and engage well with an online model. High school kids maybe, but not, I mean, elementary school kids, I think it's very difficult, especially if it wasn't taught to in advance with a plan, you know, and we're all kind of like chasing our tails, trying to find resources that don't entirely suck. But I just noticed from the last few months of last school year that the ones that needed it the most were not getting it.
Fair, you know? Yeah. And sorry, I think you already said this at the beginning of the chat when this was sort of alluded to. You don't actually know what your work year is going to look like yet, do you?
No, basically, they've divided it into four phases. I'm sure this is similar everywhere: green, yellow, orange, and red, based on community spread within our immediate community. Now, we're in an area where it's been relatively low, but because Idaho was early to open up completely, everybody's on vacation here now.
Mm. Right, right.
So, we'll see. So we're kind of guessing that we're probably going to start in yellow, which is a regular model with social distancing 4 days a week instead of five, but I honestly have no idea how they'll pull it off, because I have 32 kids registered in my classroom, and if you have social distancing, you can fit 16. So, you know.
Again, I'm trying not to blame. My wife is kind of like, stupid government, and I'm like, I mean, I'm not a fan of the government here, but I don't know. There are people to blame. There's blame to go around, but I'm just not. It doesn't help me deal with it, too.
It doesn't solve anything. Yeah.
No, I there are going to be villains in all sorts of scenarios, and a lot of them are the ones who are politicizing this. And that part I don't like, but I'm also like, honestly, I don't think anyone exactly knows what to do, because they don't like what the epidemiologists and experts are saying, so they deny it. And that's kind of human nature. Anyway, sorry, I didn't mean to sort of come to the end of this talk with this grim
It's the world we're living in, you know? And
yeah.
And again, I'm thankful to be able to have creative outlets and to be able to have opportunities to talk, have interesting conversations about music and art and poetry with people.
Yeah.
And when a lot of people are in panic mode and glued to the media and emotions and things are running high. And so I think to take a moment and acknowledge what is good on this earth, and that we are human beings and that we are extremely resilient by our very nature. We just need to remind ourselves of that, and we just need to have the eyes to see the positivity and the ears to hear it and the voices to speak it amidst all the chaos.
Yeah, I would agree with you. In terms of future plans, I mean, we're talking about this volume of poetry. We're talking about your new record, and I'm going to ask you to help us find that stuff and tell us where to go online or wherever to get these things. But you also, are you the principal operator of New Rot Recordings? That's your label?
Yep. I mean, the band kind of oversees what we do artistically, but it's always, for the last 20 years, been run out of my house. And I got a couple of folks that help me out with it. A label manager to do the day-to-day grunt work while I'm busy at school, and people to help us with social media and we hire the PR outside. But yeah, it's all basically run on the other side of the wall from here.
So I guess within what I'm getting at here, future plans for you, future plans for Neurosis, it sounds like everything's on hold at the moment. But any releases or anything else you want to tell us about in terms of New Rot Recordings or other things?
New Rot Recordings, we have a pretty interesting release coming out. Obviously, we've been working really hard on my record, which comes out, we're speaking on a Thursday, it comes out tomorrow.
Yeah.
Next month we have a project called Deaf Brick, which is a collaboration between Deaf Kids, a really interesting band from Brazil that we've been championing for the last couple years. Just really powerfully inspired young guys playing a really unique, intense type of music. It really really is incredible. So the Deaf Kids have collaborated with a band called Pet Brick out of the UK, which is Igor Cavalera of Sepultura, and a guy from another noise-making project there in London. And they kind of do strange, glitchy electronic stuff. So it's kind of mixing these two worlds. It's really intense. I'm proud to put that out into the universe. It's collaboration with Rocket Recordings. They're doing it in the UK. We're doing it here.
Okay.
Other than that, really, it's just kind of been wait and see what's going on, you know?
Right.
I had like everybody, I had to cancel my plans to tour this record and promote the book live this summer. So hopefully those opportunities will represent themselves next year at some point.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I think, I don't know.
Yeah, no, that's, I don't know is a fair thing to say a lot these days. So don't feel bad about that.
I do not know.
I don't know.
If anybody knows, let me know.
So where would you send people who, as I say, if we want to guide people to find your record, your book, New Rot Recordings, where would you send people for these things?
Vontil.org. for my stuff and neurotrecordings.com. You'll end up at the same stores,
right,
for both,
right,
but you'll get different information at the head start of it. So that's where to find me.
Okay, cool. Now, if we can go out on a piece from, let's say, No Wilderness Deep Enough, which would you, first of all, tell me if that's okay. Secondly, what would you select?
That's absolutely okay.
appreciate that.
Maybe one that hasn't been out there yet. Maybe Trail the Silent Hours.
Trail the Silent Hours. Now, why did that come to mind? Why did you want to pick that one?
Because just as we were talking about kind of, and again, these words weren't written this year. They weren't written knowing what was ahead of us. These were just, a lot of times words can take on a new meaning, almost like reading tea leaves or pulling a tarot card. In order to kind of reframe your life in the future. You know, the meaning becomes clearer later. Mm. But there's just some lines in that that kind of make sense to right now. Like, confusion carries us through the night. We will always stumble in the dark. And then it ends. Stand then as an oak holding ground. Seek shelter and surrender, but don't give in.
Yeah, that is it is very powerful, and it is very... I guess it's prescient in a sense. There's a lot of this going on, I feel. I've been speaking with artists who've written songs before this that weirdly seem to anticipate scenarios that they weren't even contemplating. But I think coincidence and reality have an interesting relationship in our lives.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay, well, that's a great selection. This is Trail the Silent Hours from No Wilderness Deep Enough. Steve, thank you so much for making time, for being on this show and being so thoughtful with this conversation and your work. It means a lot, and I wish you the best of luck with everything going forward.
Yeah, thank you, Vish. Really appreciate being on the show. Tearing apart.
void. Stand then as an oak, holding ground, seek shelter in surrender. Don't give in.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Very special thanks to Steve Von Till for being on this, the 561st. Yeah, 561st. Is it 561? That's a lot. 561 episodes? I think that's correct. Yes, he's on the 561st episode of Creative Control, which is part of the Entertainment One podcast network, and we're available on all Apple and Google platforms and other things, too. Oh, of note, we are no longer available on Audioboom. We had a long relationship with Audioboom, but we recently switched our RSS feeds and everything else is fine, but Audioboom's like, you're switching your feed? Get out of here. So I'm like, all right, fine. So no more Audioboom. So if you used to listen to the show on Audioboom, or if you know anyone who does, just tell them we're not there anymore, which is sad, but what are you going to do? It's podcasts. It's just podcasts. Nothing you can do. It's podcast land. Podcast town? Why am I quoting Chinatown? If you can't find an episode of the show that you're looking for, or if you want to learn more about me and sign up for my semi-regularly scheduled newsletter, please visit my website, vishkana.com. You can follow Creative Control on Twitter at vishcreative, or follow me directly at vishkana. Also visit patreon.com/creativecontrol to make a flexible monthly donation to keep this podcast going, got some new people who have donated to the show. They've signed up for the monthly stuff. Thank you for doing that. Patreon.com/creativecontrol for more info about how to do that. Thanks again to liveatmasseyhall.com, where you can watch beautifully captured concerts by some really great Canadian artists there. Also, thanks to Pizza Trocadero, The Bookshelf, and Planet Bean Coffee in Guelph, and Granddad's Donuts in Hamilton for their in-kind support for this show. As always, thanks to my friend Jim Guthrie for lending me some music for this show. You can learn more about Jim at jimguthrie.org. And finally, thank you for listening to this episode with Steve. I hope you enjoyed it, and if you've not heard the show before, I hope you will consider digging in to past episodes and maybe following the show, however you follow things or subscribe to them or whatever it is you do. Maybe talking about the show with your friends, that seems to help when people say, hey, did you hear this the thing? And the other friend says, the what thing? And you have to be more specific. And then you explain it a bit more, and they say, oh yeah, okay, I guess I'll check that out. Just remind me. Can you make a group calendar reminder so that I can remember to check that out later? And you say, what? I'm telling you now. Why isn't this enough? You need me to... God, you are annoying. And then your friendship breaks up because of my podcast. Anyway, that's it for me. I'll talk to you soon. Bye for now.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.